The presenters, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 presentations we dealt with in session 2.
Mr. Chairperson, thank you very much. Hopefully the National Treasury, when they come to respond, they will assist in clarifying some of the issues that have been raised by the various organizations that presented here. But in the main, I think I am in total agreement with the presentation by COSATU. But as far as the other presentations are concerned, I've got one question on water. On slide 12, on slide 12, I think there's a point where they are saying South Africa must first be on course to a sustainable economic recovery, at least be able to achieve 3 to 4% over a period of 3 years prior to the introduction of carbon tax. The issue I'm raising here is, earlier on, I think there was also a point made that, was it by WWF, that if we don't go this route of ensuring that we introduce carbon tax, we risk losing out in terms of being able to trade with some countries, especially under European Union. So meaning if we don't introduce this, we may actually not be able to realize this economic recovery that is being alluded to in this slide 12. So I just want their comment on that one. And but also that the next point under the same slide, they are saying by introducing carbon tax at this point is contrary to the socio-economic objectives of South Africa and will unfortunately suffer a state of increased cost of doing business blah blah blah. My contention here is that if we don't introduce this carbon tax, we actually risk again that sustainable growth that we are supposed to achieve. Because if we allow the status quo to actually remain, the danger is that whatever growth we may realize will actually be short-lived, given huge risks that will actually ensue emanating from negative climate change that will actually be caused by us not introducing carbon tax. So I just want them to comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you. You may reply. Let's start from the top, WWF.
So thank you.
Actually, just making reference to the point that WWF made.
I think the question
and
is...
And the question is still, directed to what?
That is a very good remark, and thank you for the role you are playing. Ota?
Thanks, Chair. Yes, from our analysis, we realize that given the fragility of our economy, we really need to tread very, very carefully in terms of increasing the burden on our already, overtaxed citizens. That's how, actually, from an outer point of view, we looked at it. The reality is that, Che, as we speak now, when you look at the trajectory of our energy pricing, especially electricity, it is quite steep. It's very high. Our electricity prices have increased by more than 300% in the 5-10 years. In the last 10 years. And then we acknowledge the reality that climate change is affecting us, it's happening. However, we say that as a developing country, we need to balance our socio-economic imperatives with the need to raise revenues. For instance, when you look at our unemployment levels, they are very high. And then our economic growth is very, very low. And then unfortunately, due to legacy matters, our, inequalities are still unfortunate. So we concluded that given the fact that South Africa is aspiring actually to propel its economy to be on the trajectory of high growth, so that we can start to mitigate and address our social ills, it's very, very important that various mechanisms that promote or incentivize economic development has to be promoted. And then carbon tax, as we speak now, in its form, is not necessarily the right thing to do. For instance, most of the companies, you'll find that, have already initiated programs to reduce their emissions levels. When you look at it from an industry point of view, mining and other high energy intensive industries, we are very, very much aware that they are doing it as part of their corporate plans and all strategies. So we were emphasizing, like for instance, the reality of saying that National Treasury has to work hand in hand with other government departments. For instance, look at the 9 cent petrol, levy which they introduced. We are still actually in terms of fuel, not using cleaner fuel. We are not using cleaner petrol. And then the Department of Energy is still struggling to find measures of how to introduce cleaner fuels. So if the DOE is still struggling to do that, shouldn't we invest in helping the DOE and the petroleum sector to actually bring us cleaner fuels than actually increase the high carbon, carbon tax? So those are the things which we said that as stakeholders, we need to engage with government, and you, the policymakers, you help us to strike the necessary balance so that we can be able to take the country forward. It shouldn't be only on the achievement of revenue, a target. It should actually go hand in hand in addressing our socio-economic dynamics. So that's what actually we are imploring from civil society point of view. And then the thing of, let's say for instance, that we are likely to find ourselves being put in a corner by other European countries saying that they won't take or trade more with us because our products are produced from high carbon content processes. We don't want us to look at it from that point of view, because we say that as South Africans, let's first look at our South African problems and challenges and then find a common and local approach to it. Then other international, best practices, we can adopt them and customize them to the South African environment and needs, rather than take them as a copy and paste from what London adopts, and we say as South Africans we adopt. We say we need to find our own South African solutions to our South African problems as South Africa Incorporated. Thanks, Chair.
Unfortunately, Chair,
Honorable,
we are part of this globe, of this village. We can't operate outside it. No, I just wanted to say that.
You are 100% correct. If you attend the Commonwealth Parliament Association Conference for Africa, then you realize this. And when you go internationally for the global conference, you realize it much more, that we must work together globally, not only here on our island. I noted your hand.
Thanks. Yeah, and I think to respond to Honorable Monaketti's question, do we need a carbon tax and so on? Look, I think I'll take the same stance as Honorable Monaketti. We live in a village, a global village. And for us, we don't want to see anything which would jeopardize our potential to export, for example, to the EU, one of our key trading partners. We know they are going to require the carbon pricing as part of the export requirements. So we have to deal with that reality. I think, Chair, look, we're never going to find COSATU dancing in the street saying, thank you, government, for increasing taxes. Unless it's on the bourgeoisie or the rich, then we'll change.
I've never seen that before.
But, Chair, look, for us, I think we want to engage in real politics. We know the tax is going to happen. We do concede that government has made some concessions around the tax, especially towards agriculture, etc. We haven't wanted to collapse the tax because we do feel industry does need to change. Pollution, it's a huge problem. Industry is a key part of that problem. Our concern, Chair, really has been as a trade union federation, is what is government and industry's plans towards a job, a just transition? Can we protect vulnerable workers who are losing their jobs and going to lose their jobs? And can we have a serious plan to take that 37% of workers who are unemployed away from hopelessness into jobs? We think if we are serious as a nation, we can do it, and the time is now. We can't afford to wait for another water crisis, for example, in Cape Town, or afford to wait for 50,000 coal and other workers in Mpumalanga to be rendered unemployed in the next few years, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Box. Busa, I'm a Democrat. I'm giving you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. I think in all fairness, I mean, as we indicated right at the beginning, Busa's position is we are supportive of a transition for the South African economy. Like all our members, we have very clearly demonstrated that we are committed to doing something. As I've indicated, though, we don't believe that the instrument is the carbon tax, given the current state of the economy. Having said that, there are other instruments that are already being proposed. And in fact, we have regulations already governing how greenhouse gas emissions will be emitted in the economy. We are saying we need to actually find a mechanism that balances all of the different priorities. We don't believe that the carbon tax in its current form addresses this issue. There are far too many gaps and far too many issues that make it very uncertain into the future, making it difficult for us to plan to balance the competing priorities that we need to balance. And that really is the position we are taking, is that we need to do something. We recognize climate change, but we don't believe the carbon tax in a standalone manner without the areas addressed are going to address the issue at hand. Thank you.
Thank you. We acknowledge the presence of Honorable Mohai, Chief Whip of the National Council of Provinces. Thank you, Honorable Mohai, and Honorable Mohai is representing the Free State. I call it the center of South Africa, but it's not 100% correct. It's Kimberley. there's a beacon just outside Kimberley on the way to Douglas. That's the center of South Africa. Yeah, I went to all these historians, and they told me that story. I leave it there. That's just a short commercial. All the members... Pardon? Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to give an example about the automotive sector. So the automotive sector, original equipment manufacture, assembly and production of vehicles in South Africa, has long been one of the key pillars of our industrial policy and action plan. And what we are seeing now is that around the world, cities and governments and like American, you know, their national government is unspeakable, but some of their states are also starting to set targets after which they will not allow internal combustion engines in their area of governance. So I understand that we don't cookie cutter what is happening globally, especially not in the developed world, because it doesn't suit our context. But this is where we export the vehicles that we manufacture to. And if there's not a market for our vehicles, our industry here in South Africa will shrink and shrink. So we can either just continue to close our eyes to that and suddenly be faced with a shrinking market and plants closing, or we can say, well, we want to position our country to be a center of electric vehicle manufacture. And I know I was last week with someone from the DTI, who said that that is now becoming part of the... They've just completed a study about the impact of electric vehicles uptake globally and locally, but globally, on our manufacturing sector and our liquid fuel sector, because it obviously impacts both. And they are looking at how, in the IPAP, they can start to support the emergence of an EV industry.
Thank you for that. I'm going to give honourable members the Treasury and our gentleman from SARS the opportunity to reply. I'm going to give you 30 minutes because that is the second last point on the agenda that we are bringing forward now. So over to you. You can divide the time between your amongst you as a team.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon.
We are here representing National Treasury. Our DDG, Mr. Ismail Momoniat, couldn't come because his acting DG, as the DG is overseas. He wanted to be specifically present in the house when we're doing the presentation. So he asked us to represent National Treasury in this regard as the acting DG. I want to say, in terms of public consultation, the carbon tax discussion paper was first published in 2010. So we were almost 10 years into the discussion of the carbon tax. And then the carbon tax policy paper was later published in 2013, and then the carbon offset paper in 2014. And then in 2015, the draft carbon tax bill was published, and in 2017, a draft carbon tax bill was published again. So that shows that National Treasury has been consulting with the stakeholders, and in publishing all these papers and in all these draft bills, we have been making concessions and changes going along. And I just want to say today, on the 14th of March 2018, there was a joint committee meeting of Department of Environmental Affairs and Finance, and almost all the commentators or stakeholders that are present today were also present in that meeting. We have the agendas of those meetings. And then the issues that they are raising today are the same points that they have raised in previous meetings. And those issues we've also responded to in the response document. But we're going to respond to them again today. The three general issues are the alignment of carbon tax with carbon budget, is the ring fencing of revenue from carbon tax, is the administration of carbon tax through customs and excise. And then there are specific issues that have been raised, like your electricity price neutrality, the jobs mitigation strategy, and taxation of domestic aviation. All of those issues that they are raising today, we've already responded to. But on the issue of customs and excise, the SARS official is here. But we want to say in the House that we have already had public consultations regarding this issue. And with the fact that the rules are not published yet for administering the customs and the carbon tax through customs and excise, in terms of the procedure, the bill first has to be passed before we can do a secondary legislation. So we said, with the permission of this House and also the Standing Committee on Finance, is it okay to do the rules before the bill has been passed by this House? Because we do not want to be undermining Parliament and start with the secondary legislation before the bill is passed. But during our hearings in the Standing Committee on Finance, they said that they understand the predicament that we cannot do the rules or the regulation before the primary legislation is passed. But they said that maybe towards the end of March or beginning of April, we can publish the rules for public comments, that is the rules for administering the customs and the carbon tax through customs and excise. This is what SARS is going to do, even though we are not supposed to publish the rules before the bill is passed. But this is what we're going to do. And Charlene will speak about the alignment, Charlene and memory, and price neutrality and jobs. And the SARS people will speak about the administration of carbon tax through customs and excise.
Thanks very much, Yangan, and thanks to the colleagues for the presentations. It's been a long road in terms of developing this instrument and the consultations. As Yanga has said, a lot of the issues were raised before. I think we need to clarify certain areas, as she's done on the rules to the Customs and Excise Act. But specifically on the issues raised, we've gone through the submissions, and the issues around alignment apply in two areas. Or three areas. So it's basically in terms of the alignment of the carbon tax and the carbon budget. So what happened was, during the consultation, this issue was raised initially in terms of the SCOF process, and there were views of stakeholders. Some of the view that we need to very clearly in the current bill specify what this alignment would be, while others were of the view that these are two separate instruments, there's no need for alignment. We took those views into account, and we, in terms of providing that policy certainty that was requested in terms of a mandatory carbon budget instrument, we then, in the MTBPS last year, our minister announced an alignment of the carbon tax and the carbon budget. And this followed on consultations that were held between the Department of Environmental Affairs and business around a paper that was published on the actual options that could be considered. So we took those into account together with the Department of Environmental Affairs. On an in-principle basis, we basically announced what this alignment could be in an effort to address some of the concerns around policy certainty. This announcement was made in the NTBPS in October last year, where we said that the current tax treatment would apply to the extent that emissions reported are equal to the carbon budget determined by the Department of Environmental Affairs, and then for any emissions above that, there will be a higher tax rate applied. These issues were raised in the SCoF process again, and we then engaged industry around two areas, around the nature of this alignment, what the higher tax rate would be, and then secondly, concerns that this alignment was not reflected in the actual carbon tax bill. We consulted with stakeholders in November last year to clarify their concerns, and we had basically agreed that this proposal of the higher tax rate on emissions when it exceeds the budget, this will form part of the consultations that we would have with industry and other stakeholders going forward, and this future alignment does not technically impact the current design of the carbon tax. And we had committed to that engagement. And then with respect to reflecting in this current bill that alignment, we were not able to do that because the carbon budget is currently proposed in terms of another bill, the climate change bill, which has not been promulgated as yet. So that alignment will only be reflected once the climate change bill is enacted.
When will that be?
The Climate Change Bill is currently in the Parliament Cabinet process, and my colleague from Environmental Affairs is here, and he can respond to that. It's currently in the Cabinet process. It's been put forward to Parliament, but he'll elaborate, and it's also currently within the NEDLAC process where there are discussions on the bill. So I can ask through you, Chair, my colleague from the Department of Environmental Affairs, to just add, if that's okay.
What's he said so far?
Yeah,
this is business class. You must sit here. Yeah.
Thank you, members, and thank you, colleagues. I'm sitting here at the back because I was too early, I think. And the colleagues from National Treasury came later, so I didn't know where they were going to sit. And apologies for that. Yeah, the colleague from Treasury, she's right to say the climate change bill is in the cabinet processes. It's still going through government cluster so that we can ask cabinet to allow us to consult with parliament. But parallel to that, there's an intellect process that has been established. Last year, when we were talking about this alignment, I was under the impression that we all understood that it was not legally possible for this carbon tax bill to refer to the future alignment because it would be referring to the instrument that is not legally promulgated, and once that is promulgated, it shall be possible that we refer to that, and that the proposal was that can be done through the amendments of the Act. So, in as far as we are concerned, that's where we are as Environmental Affairs. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of that legal process, that was the answer we were given by the State Law Advisor. and we even committed on page 11 of the response document to say that a Carbon Tax Amendment Act will give effect to the necessary changes to align the carbon tax and the carbon budget established by the Climate Change Act. Because we had the amendments ready, but they said, no, you can never legally make changes to something which is not yet there. So it was difficult to do that.
Thanks, Yanga and Mac. And Chair, just lastly, on the future alignment of the carbon tax and the carbon budget, which we also mentioned last week, is that we view the carbon tax as a broad-based carbon pricing measure, you know, as a way to create those price signals to encourage changes in behavior in both producers and consumers, and to in that way help us to reduce our emissions. In the way we've designed the tax is that we've taken a phased approach to the introduction. So rather than just implement the tax at a very high rate initially, we opted to go for a low rate and then phase that in over a period of time. We note that the carbon tax forms part of the package of measures that is being developed by government, including the carbon budget, to help us meet our obligations in terms of the Paris Agreement. And as part of that package, we also recognize the role for tax incentives and to the extent that it is possible on budget allocations in terms of helping to make this transition to a low-carbon economy. So that's in response to the alignment of the carbon tax and the carbon budget. The second issue which Yanga spoke about and has been raised is around the issue of earmarking. Revenue earmarking, and that's a word that the Treasury doesn't like. So generally, our policy is that, you know, earmarking introduces, it's a very rigid type of mechanism. It doesn't allow us flexibility in terms of the way we allocate funding, and it also could result in under-allocating or over-allocating for certain priorities of government. So from that perspective, we don't support earmarking. However, when it came to this tax instrument and even in terms of the modeling that we've done, it was very clear that the way we use the revenues, how we recycle the revenues, can help us achieve emission reductions but also limit the impacts in terms of economic growth. So specifically for this tax, there are three ways that we propose to recycle the revenue. The one was in terms of recycling some of the revenues in terms of the current electricity generation levy. So we said that there were, for the first phase of the tax up to 2022, there would be no impact on the price of electricity, and that will be achieved through including the credit for the current electricity generation levy, which was mentioned already, against the carbon tax liability of an electricity generator. And on this particular policy, this was a concession that was made during the consultation processes, probably around 2014, 2015, in consultation with industry, because this issue was raised. We specifically then amended the bill, I think it was the 2015 version of the bill, to allow for this electricity price neutrality, and it is in Section 6.2. Of the bill. So this is catered for in the current bill. In terms of how this would be claimed, it will basically be a subtraction against the carbon tax liability of an entity. So that is how we propose to address this issue that was raised earlier around alignment with the electricity generation levy that is in place. The second way we said that we would recycle some of the revenues, which we've mentioned previously as well, is around tax incentives. So we implemented the energy efficiency savings tax incentive in 2013, and that was viewed even at that time as a critical instrument as part of the package of measures around the carbon tax. And our initial analysis basically shows that the biggest sectors benefiting from this is mining and manufacturing. Our conservative estimates around the how much this tax incentive is costing the fiscus is around $3 billion. So in budget this year, we announced that we would extend the duration of that incentive, which was supposed to come to an end at the end of this year. And that is now going to be aligned with the first phase of the carbon tax, and it will come to an end in on the 31st of December 2022. So that's the two ways in which we've said there will be direct revenue recycling in terms of the carbon tax. We've also, as part of, in terms of our response document, we've specified that if you're looking at these two revenue recycling measures and the 90, up to 95% tax-free allowances that an entity can claim, there will be little revenue left over to actually, or possibly no revenue left over to actually, if you had to earmark the tax. So what we did say, and which is an area that we also view as a priority, is that there could be a way of allocating more funding or support around public transport. There's a free basic electricity energy allocation that is made for households. We could also look at enhancing those. There we will need to look for funds probably even outside of the fiscus through some of the international climate funding that's coming into the country. So we have made, we have responded in terms of that in the response document. So that deals with the issue around revenue recycling and earmarking of the tax. We note some of the submissions raise the issues around competitiveness, and we've had various responses to that. I think just to flag some in terms of the concessions that was made, we did change the design of the trade exposure allowance to make it easier for sectors to actually tap into that allowance. And we also would just also like to state that as what we are finding is that as you're moving forward, this issue of competitiveness will start to be reduced, because internationally there is increasing number of countries that are actually implementing these instruments, including in the major developing economies such as India, Brazil. China has already implemented a carbon pricing instrument. Indonesia, Singapore. So there's a lot of countries that have done this. The other area that was spoken about a lot in terms of alignment, and I don't know if the colleagues are here, but around the alignment of the carbon tax on domestic aviation with the global COSIA mechanism. So my colleague Memory will talk through that.
Thank you, Shailen. Afternoon, honorable members. So in terms of the aviation sector, what we did is we consulted with the industry to try and align with the international mechanism, which is still under development. So in November 2017, we developed a proposal for them. So under the international mechanism, the airline industries is being encouraged to, I think they put out the basket of measures, including technology and fuel efficiency and using a carbon offsetting mechanism. So because that international mechanism is still under design, we've also tried to make sure that the carbon tax caters to that for the aviation industry, so that there will be a seamless transition for them to be able to report internationally and what they report nationally. So to facilitate that, we increased their basic tax-free allowance. Everyone else has a 60% basic tax-free allowance, but we increased it to 75% from 60%. And we've also allowed, they're the only transportation sector that has been allowed to use a performance allowance, because that will allow them to implement performance measures that will also align with the COSIA basket of measures in terms of fuel efficiency and the like. And we've also allowed them to, we've increased their offset allowance from 5% to 10%, and increased their overall tax-free allowance from 90% to 95%.
So this was part of the consultations with the aviation industry, and we received, if I remember correctly, comments on the proposals from IATA and the Civil Aviation Authority. So that's the big concession that was also made in terms of the 2018 version of the bill through the process last year. The other area that has been mentioned and we take cognizance of, and we've taken cognizance of through the process, was around jobs. We engaged together with representatives of government and labor who are here today in the NEDLAC process on the development of a jobs mitigation and creation plan. We came up with a plan that there was broad commitment on, and specifically the initiatives are targeted around the energy, building, water, waste, biodiversity, transport sectors. In terms of the focus of it, which we think is important, is that as we make this transition, there will be a need to use existing skills and reskill people to help them move into other industries. And also the potential for entrepreneurship for these new clean, green industries that could be developed. So the whole area around an assessment of the existing skills, options for improving on those skills, looking at new types of training programs and capacity building initiatives would be key. And we've put forward that specific proposal in the context of the NEDLAC process. The second area which we noted as very important, which is through a carbon pricing instrument, there are also incentives being created for industries to basically invest in options for research, development, technology innovation. So it's not just in terms of reducing emissions, but also to create that incentives over the medium to longer term for looking at what are the alternative options, alternative industries to help diversify sectors. So we are of the view that research, development, and technology innovation is going to be key for this transition that we need to make. And our Department of Science and Technology has agreed to work together with industries on the opportunities for research, development, technology innovation, look at specific partnerships that could be developed around particular technologies and research and making these commercially viable, as well as looking at opportunities for financial support. And we are committed to implementing these proposals, which forms part of the Job Summit agreement. So that is high level in response to the technical issues around the tax. I'm going to hand over to my colleague from SARS, who will deal with the difficult issues around the administration of the tax on the Customs and Excise Act.
Thank you, colleagues, and thank you, Chair. Good afternoon on behalf of SARS. I have to reiterate what my Treasury colleagues have said, that it's surprising some of the issues that industry have raised today, because all of these issues have been raised before. They've been, as far as we are aware, they were addressed. There were concrete proposals put on the table to compromise, to come up with innovative solutions to the administration of this tax under the Customs and Excise Act. But to just demonstrate how we've facilitated that, I think it's important that I maybe just touch on some of the specific issues that were raised today, specifically by Sasol and by Busa. On the Sasol questions, the issue of unintentional non-compliance and the top-off if an under-declaration occurs, that I think that uncertainty arises from a much earlier version of the carbon tax bill, when there was still a design that foresaw provisional accounts and estimates being done. That's, for some time, has not been the case. The current design of the bill foresees an annual accounting period, which corresponds with the reporting period to the Environmental Affairs from January to December. Then, of course, the reporting entity has from January until March of the following year to do its reporting to the Department of Environmental Affairs. And then in April and May, the Department of Environmental Affairs would verify those emissions declarations. SARS then would give another month's grace during the month of June, and it's only in the following year, basically, in July, that a taxpayer would have to submit an environmental levy account. So 6 months after the reporting period, 6 months after you've done the taxpayer's done its own calculation of its own emissions, with the account bidue and the payment bidue. So it's highly unlikely that there could be any unintentional non-compliance. A company must be certain by that stage what its emissions are that is reported to the Environmental Affairs Department, and that is the figure that needs to be declared on the account that is then submitted to SARS with the payment. So the issue of unintentional non-compliance and 80-20 principle of what we would accept as acceptable levels of compliance, I think is a non-issue. 6 months is sufficient time for a company to be certain of what its emissions were in the preceding calendar year. So the issue of penalties then also becomes a non-issue, because penalties in the Customs and Excise Act is based on behavior. If a company is consistently under-declaring, if a company is consistently submitting its accounts late, then the penalties would become an issue. But as I said, 6 months after the fact, there shouldn't be any such issues arising. The suggestion that we should postpone the implementation under the Customs and Excise Act until the Customs Control Act has been promulgated is also irrelevant, because the purpose of the Customs Control Act is to separate out all the customs provisions out of the Customs and Excise Act. The Customs Control Act has no relevance to excise duties or environmental levies whatsoever, because the Customs and Excise Act as it stands will remain after the customs provisions have been separated out. So the 1964 Act without its customs provisions would become the new Excise Duty Act. It has its own rewrite process involved, that it would be reviewed against current best practice, but that would be a separate process, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the Customs Control Act or the promulgation of that act. And that brings us to, I think, the last major point there was about how the reporting to the Environmental Affairs Department would be at a company level, and the perception is that the Customs and Excise Act, the licensing under the Customs and Excise Act of facilities would be incompatible. We've engaged on this directly with industry and at committee level and through response documents as well to demonstrate that it is workable. That we, as SARS, put our proposal on the table that we would consider licensing facilities not based on premises but based on the activities in terms of which those that company reports emissions to the Environmental Affairs. So you would have a license over several facilities, basically making up one licensed entity that would have a common denominator, would be the activity in terms of which it is reporting emissions. And you would still have the one company as the taxpayer, because the license holder is the taxpayer. So there's no anomaly or inconsistency in what we're proposing on how to license facilities with common activities, and how that common licensee or license holder, which is the company, would be responsible for accounting for the tax and for the payments of the tax. That, I think, covers most of the SASOL points. As far as the BUSA issues are concerned, my colleagues from Treasury have touched on why it's difficult for us to put the rules out for comments until the primary legislation has reached finality through the parliamentary process. We have given an undertaking as far as that we would publish the rules for comments as soon as it's possible, which would probably be end of March, beginning of April, once the primary legislation has reached finality. From the engagements that we've had with industry directly and at committee level and through response documents, we've made it clear that you would, how the tax would be administered. So although the rules aren't out in a formal manner for comments, we've had given undertakings and clarity to industry on how we would administer the tax. The concerns around the allowance is being treated as refunds or rebates or drawbacks. It's also similarly a non-issue. The allowances are deductions that reduce the tax base of the tax. It reduces your taxable emissions. So the Customs and Excise Act is in the schedules to the Act. Treat those allowances as rebates in the sense that it would reduce the tax liability. There would be no issue of waiting or going through a complicated application for refund process and waiting for rebates. It's basically a deduction that is set off against the taxable emissions on the account. I think most of the other issues that Vusa raised, the duplicate questions around what Sasol raised around the licensing, the manner of submission of the accounts, I think I've covered. The penalty provisions, which would not really be an issue because you're only going to be submitting your account 6 months after the tax period. And then the last point was on the deduction of carbon tax for income tax purposes. That's always been the understanding all along, so it's uncertain why it's suddenly a concern. The carbon tax would be an environmental levy, and like other levies and excise duties, it would be deductible for income tax purposes. Thank you.
Thanks, Erwin. And then lastly, there were several comments on the regulations to the Carbon Tax Act. So just by way of an update quickly, on the carbon offset regulations, which give effect to the up to 10% carbon offset allowance that an entity can claim. We've had consultations with industry since 2014. So we put out an initial carbon offsets paper. There were consultations on this, on the design of the offset scheme, what type of projects would be eligible, what are the methodologies that can be used to measure those emission savings from those offset projects. And then in 2016, we put out a draft regulation in June 2016. This was consulted on in November that year. This was followed by consultations in 2017 with BUSA specifically on the design of on the carbon offset regulations. The regulation sets out some of the eligibility criteria around the projects that would qualify. That means local projects in South Africa, what type of standards can be used to develop these projects, so using methodologies through the Clean Development Mechanism, Gold Standard, and the Verified Carbon Standard, which is a voluntary standard, so that we make sure that these offsets are credible, that when we say one ton of emission reduced is equal to one ton of emission reduced across the different standards, so it maintains the integrity of the instrument. In terms of that regulation, what we've then done is put out a revised regulation in November 2018. Comments closed, I think, on the 14th or 15th of December last year, and we received 26 sets of comments thus far. One of the big concessions we made in terms of that regulation is that initially we had a blanket exclusion for renewable energy type projects. But in terms of that regulation, there were arguments that certain small-scale renewable energy projects or less than 50 megawatts did not have an incentive mechanism, so we included those within as being eligible for use as offsets by industries to reduce their tax liability. The regulation also gave more detail around the administration of the offset allowance, and the process that procedure that will be followed. So we will be having a stakeholder workshop later this month. I think we've confirmed the date for the 27th of March to basically have a final round of consultation and finalize those regulations. The second regulation, the other two, is on the trade exposure allowance and the benchmark. On the trade exposure allowance, we also had based on the comments from industry and stakeholders, we changed the design of that. We made it simpler, and we went for a sector-based allowance rather than company-based. allowance, and this is to help those industries that are trade exposed. This allowance was then further developed in close consultation with BUSA through a technical study on the methodology for determining the allowance and the sectors that would qualify. The regulation will essentially be a list of those sectors and the allowances that they qualify for. At this stage, our view is that industry is aware of what it would qualify for because it has been consulted on already. We will put out those regulations shortly that specify the sectors. To some, based on comments that we did receive from industry thus far, some sectors would be classified as subsectors to provide the clarity, and that will be consulted on and finalized thereafter. The third regulation is on the emissions intensity benchmarks for the performance allowance that's provided under the tax. On this one, this was a bit of a difficult process, but what happened was that National Treasury worked with the World Bank in and published a report on how these emissions intensity benchmarks could be developed, what type of methodologies could be used, and it covered sectors from the petroleum sector, iron and steel, cement, most of the sectors that would be subject to the tax. This was also presented to industry. It was in 2015 that this was done, and that was the basis for which we then asked or requested industries to develop these benchmark proposals. One of the reasons for putting this out and requesting industry to do it was because we didn't have the data to enable us to develop these robust benchmarks. So that was the process that was followed. So during 2017 and 2018, we then engaged quite closely with the various sectors, subsectors, on the development of these benchmarks. We had several meetings on reports. We provided comments on the methodologies, taking into account the principles put out in the guiding paper that was published. And currently, we have a whole suite of industries, which is around 10. We have around 10 proposals for benchmarks. We will also put out that regulation ASAP before the end of this month, outlining the sectors, subsectors where applicable, and those benchmark values as per our discussions. And that would be published as well. So that's an update on those regulations. And lastly, from my side, is that one of the things we have said in terms of the design of this tax and taking into account the comments was that given that the Paris Agreement operates on a five-year basis and there will be reviews of our targets that we set ourselves to reduce emissions, it is expected that each subsequent target that we set has to be stricter than the previous. So what we have said is that with this tax, we will review the impact of the tax after at least 3 years of implementation to take into account its impact in terms of helping us to reduce our emissions, as well as we will also consider review the combined impact of the motor vehicle emissions tax that we have in place and the electricity generation levy. And we'll look at the combined impact in terms of helping us to reduce our emissions. So.
You done? Thank you to Treasury. Request that that response document be submitted to Solani, please. Your stakeholders that left already, and then we can he can circulate it to them. He's got the email addresses. Thank you. That brings us to the end of this session regarding the carbon tax and the customs and excise bill, amendment bill. Thank you very much for your presentations, your inputs. Thank you to Treasury for replying. And there's some things that Parliament will have to do differently. It's to engage more robust on legislation that has been passed by Parliament. Not once a year, I would say at least twice a year. Because departments must appear before committees of Parliament on a quarterly basis. Why? To measure performance to measure the spending of taxpayers' money delivery. And that has to be changed in the Sixth Parliament, of how Parliament is doing its oversight to improve on that. Yes. Thank you. We will release you. If you drive safely. And come back again to Parliament to do your presentations. Honourable members, while they are leaving, we will now move to the last session dealing with the public investigation, investment corporation amendment bill, the PIC bill, amendment bill. The first presentation on the bill will be input on the will be Black First, Land First movement. We received the presentations on the members. This one is marked A in your pack. The presentation is 8 pages. The presentation only starts speaking to the bill on point 23, on page 3. So we want the presenters to go straight to the bill. That's what it's about. Nothing else. That's on the agenda. There's no other point on the agenda except the PIC bill. Now, somewhere there's some confusion. Bills are tabled by cabinet through the relevant minister to bring a bill to parliament. That's the national executive. And then there's a process in terms of the rules of the House, whether it be the National Assembly and whether it be the NCOP. Another type of bill can be introduced, what they call a private member's bill. There's a process for that as well, in terms of the rules of the specific House, National Assembly or NCOP. Lastly, a committee bill introduced by a committee in Parliament that goes through a specific process in terms of the rules of the NA and the rules of the NCOP. I want to put that very clearly. And after that process has been concluded, it goes to the relevant houses in the plenary where it is voted on. A committee bill is an internal parliamentary bill by a committee. And there's a specific process for that. And I refer, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, you to the rules of the NCOP, because it's very important. And that's why we are sitting here this afternoon dealing with a committee bill by a committee in Parliament. In this case, the Standing Committee on Finance that went through that process. So I hope I cleared that matter. I tried my best. Black First, Land First, I'm going to give you the 15 minutes. Let us be to the point. Thank you. Welcome. Point is that you speak, all presenters speak to the bill, please. Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Zanele Lwana. I am here on behalf of Black First Land First. We are registered as a political party with the Independent Electoral Commission, and I'm going to be making a submission before the Select Finance Committee in my capacity as the Deputy President of Black First Land First. We thought that it's very important to provide context towards our submission with regards to the Public Investment Corporation Amendment Bill. And the first really point that we would like to make as Black First Land First is to just say, first and foremost, that we'd like to focus on procurement services by government and look at demographic representation in the asset management industry. We then put forward a clear argument that such a representation, as we will demonstrate, amounts to state capture by white monopoly capital. We also, in our submission as Black First Land First, having considered the Public Investment Corporation Amendment Bill before this committee, as BLF, we are of the view that various challenges that we outline in our submission have not been meaningfully addressed by the Public Investment Corporation Bill. I think it's very important for Black First Land First to submit as well that when we look into the work of the PIC, which is the work that includes government and safeguarding in particular the pensions of our people, it's very important to make the clear point that the asset management industry in this country post 1994, which was supposed to represent a breakthrough moment and supposed to represent a moment where we would see a transformation in many key sectors of the economy, that has not happened. And that is why that even today, as we have detailed in our submission as Black First Land First, that there is a disproportionate relationship in terms of even asset managers that are practicing in the country. As we have detailed in our submission that we only have about 41 asset managers who are black in this country, who only control 5% of an industry worth trillions of rand. To be quite exact, it's about nine trillion rand. Where 41 black asset managers have to all compete for a small fraction, which is only about 400 billion rand, while the white-dominated companies expressed as white monopoly capital have freedom to have big slices on how government money is spent on 95% of the industry, all in the hands of white corporate firms, which as a result represent a minority in this country, and how even in professional disciplines, it shows how black people have been excluded. I think without wasting time, as the chair of the committee has requested in terms of focusing on our submission as Black First Land First and speak directly into points that have to do with the amendment bill that is before the committee today. So I'll go straight to point 23, where we detail what we have termed as PIC corruption as Black First Land First, where we explain that the PIC continues to give white monopoly capital public pension funds. About 4.4 trillion rand in retirement funds, and the PIC controls about 40% of this money. PIC continues to give White Monopoly Capital public pension funds. The capture of the PIC by White Monopoly Capital was organized under the tenures of Trevor Manuel and Praveen Godan at the National Treasury as ministers of finance, respectively. Unfortunately, the capture has not been stopped by their successors, the previous ministers, such as Malusi Gigaba and his deputy, Sifiso Buthelezi, and the former finance minister, Mr. Ntlantlanene, and his deputy, Mondli Gungubele. We have cited specifically examples on how money that belongs to the people of South Africa has been misused, and we have then tried to demonstrate a relationship on how money that belongs in particular to government employees who are black has been invested in companies such as Lomnin and Sibanye Stillwater. I believe it's very important to contextualize what type of company Lomnin is. Lomnin is the company that is implicated in the massacre of our people during the Marikana massacre in 2012, where at least 34 black fathers who were breadwinners in their homes lost their lives. And as a result, even the families of those who were massacred on that day still continue to languish in poverty till today. In November last year, we heard that Lomnin stood to gain a bigger slice of the PIC pie through its merger with Sibanye Stillwater. Sibanye, again, is the mining company that has been dominating the headlines in this country on unhealthy environments that have been created within the mine, where our people, particularly those who are black and miners, have been trapped underground, and most of them making it not alive out of all those tragedies that have happened. It must be stated that the Public Investment Corporation had just increased its stake in Sibanye Stillwater at the very time when the company was retrenching 7,000 workers. The PIC's hypocrisy evidently impacts negatively on job creation. In this context, a company like Oak Bay Investments, which was fighting to save about 8,000 jobs, was attacked by White Monopoly Capital. In turn, White Monopoly Capital that was hell-bent on shutting down its bank accounts and consequently depriving the workers of their jobs. The irony here is that the PIC gave more funds to Sibanye, which was busy retrenching at the time about 7,000 workers, in the interest of White Monopoly Capital. Quite clearly, Oak Bay was and continues to be punished for saving jobs, while the PIC rewards companies such as Sibanye and Lomnin to get rewarded for job cuts. It's very important that also another company where the Public Investment Corporation has a stake in is the Tiso Blackstar. The Tiso Blackstar, which is a white-owned publication. In other words, the media groups we see here benefits from pension funds of the black majority. A company such as Tiso Blackstar, which has been involved in a campaign to publish what we have termed as fake news and to publish content that protects the crimes and wrongdoings of White Monopoly Capital. We have seen that in many cases, Blackstar's conduct has not been a good example to show what it means to be media independent or media independence. In this context, it is suggested that, as we have seen attacks through the editor of the publication to the chair of the PIC, Mr. Dan Machila, we saw how these attempts were desperate, and they seemed to be the last attempt to convince political leaders to back this particular publication. In what we have termed as Black First Land First has been an attempt to get, or rather to absorb, the independent media. The PIC has invested in loss in Tiso Blackster. We have seen how the PIC has lost about two billion thus far. And in this regard, the current Tiso share price performance is self-explanatory. Apart from what we have seen in terms of the Public Investment Corporation investing in Lomnin, investing in Sibanye Stillwaters, investing in publications that aid white monopoly capital such as Tiso Blackstar, and viewing this as an indication of first and foremost not having faith, we believe as Black First Land First, in empowering black businesses. Because part of the research that we had conducted as Black First Land First, even the black-owned asset management firms that they have benefited a lot of their work from the PIC, they do not even have a 100% black composition, for example. They have, for example, in most times, a 50% black ownership, where the other 50% is still made up of representatives of white monopoly capital. So white monopoly capital, in this instance, benefits from having companies like Coronation, like Old Mutual, and many other companies which are white, and they still stand to benefit through their 50% stakes that they have through other black-owned asset management firms.
You've got 5 minutes left.
One more point that we would like to make as Black First Land First is to put it out clear that the PIC funds, I'm on point 38 now, PIC funds have been used to promote the privatization of state-owned enterprises and perpetuate state capture by white monopoly capital. And a case study, if I may put it that way, we have provided as Black First Land First, was the suspension of loans to major state-owned enterprises by Future Growth. And this then put state-owned enterprises such as Eskom and Transnet at a disadvantage, we believe. So Black First Land First, we say that the fact that the PIC does not address social responsibility commitments in relation to unemployment, poverty, and the poverty arising from the historical question of dispossession based on colonialism. To this end, the PIC's relationship with the state as an entity of the state itself and the state's responsibilities and obligation to its people are inextricably linked with each other and must not be separated. So pension contributions, which is a major part of the PIC's deposits received by workers, has not been abolished. The state must provide the total pension of the worker at the relevant time. We have a few proposals we have put forward with regards to the work that is done by the PIC as Black First Land First. And one point that we make as BLF is that we support the African National Congress resolution on the introduction of prescribed assets on the funds of financial institutions. We believe that government should channel pension funds to invest in government-approved debt for social and economic development. The fact that investors fear this, the investors know very well that such an investment of this nature from government would see the struggling SOEs that are being deliberately being deprived of funds to push the agenda of privatization. If this setup is allowed, these struggling state-owned enterprises such as Eskom would then have an opportunity to regain their stature. As Black First Manifest, we call for the judicial inquiry, a judicial commission of inquiry into the Public Investment Corporation. The judicial commission inquiry into the PIC must take findings and report and make recommendations on the following. First, how the funds of the PIC have been employed. Please say that again.
Please wrap up.
Yes.
Your time expired.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up now.
30 seconds.
Okay, as Breakfast Lenders, we call for the Judicial Commission of Inquiry, which will focus on how funds of the PIC have been employed since its inception in 2004 to date. The anti-black annual spending of government on procurement must be investigated of services and infrastructure. And the anti-black demographic representation in asset management industry must be investigated. State capture by monopoly capital by virtue of the issues we have raised. If any PIC employee or director used his or her privileges, opposition or confidential information to improperly benefit another person for this or for personal gain must be investigated. And further recommendations that we make as Black First Land First is that 80% of all PIC mandate must go to black asset management companies, and government must publish all the companies that got business from PIC. Thank you.
Thank you. You used nearly 20 minutes. Omar Bungane, are you ready? Thank you for your presentation. Did you present to the Commission on the PIC as well? No, I'm asking.
Me?
No. The presentation you've done, just given us, are you presenting also to the PIC Commission?
Yeah, we shall do so.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Sir, are you ready? Where are they? What's this? Amma Bungani? Oh, there you are. While they are preparing themselves, honourable members, this committee appreciates the work of the Commission dealing with the PIC. Let's be very clear about that. This committee is not interfering in the business of the PIC. It's a commission appointed by the executive. And the PIC report to the national executive. Yes. In terms of the comity bill, it's a parliamentary process that parliaments deal with. Yeah. There's a difference. Are you ready?
Yeah.
You may proceed. 15 minutes to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Karawara Juli and I'm from the Amma Bungane Center for Investigative Journalism. I'm here with counsel who we have briefed to assist us in making the submission to the Select Committee. To start off to explain who we are and why we are making a submission as journalists, Amabongani is a non-profit media company, and we were founded in 2009 to not only develop investigative journalism in the public interest, but also ensure that media serves the interest of creating a more open and democratic society. Part of our work is not just to do investigative journalism, but also to identify places where information flows make it difficult for us to undertake our investigations, but also for the wider good of increasing transparency in our democracy. We therefore have made comments on the committee initiated at also the private members bill, which Parliament initiated in 2017. And in making our submission, we've been very limited to say we only look at aspects of the bill which may limit the free flow of information as well as media freedom. We do this because not only because this will benefit our own work as investigative journalists, but because we believe that in making submissions on transparency and accountability, it will also benefit the wider public as well. So that's sort of the general public good. And I'm going to hand over to my colleagues shortly, but I think it's just to, one, commend Parliament for initiating this bill proactively in response to the media reporting around the wrongdoing which was taking place at the Public Investment Corporation. So I do want to acknowledge the work that Parliament has done to be proactive in this regard. We are, however, differing from some of the other submissions that will be made regarding whether or not this bill should be adopted as it is. We make our these submissions because we want to ensure that the final bill, which is adopted by Parliament, adequately addresses what the transparency and accountability needs for the Public Investment Corporation. We have, and then just to acknowledge that Amabongani does do several other submissions to other committees within Parliament. We've made submissions on the Companies Act, on the copyright, on the Political Party Funding Bill, as well as the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill. So a core part of our mandate is to make these submissions in the public interest. On this point, I'm going to hand over to Advocate Stuart Scott, who we have briefed as counsel.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, Chairperson and members of the committee. As Karabo said, I'm an advocate from the Johannesburg Bar, now a representative from my instructing attorneys here as well. Now, just a housekeeping issue, Chair. I understand you've been handed copies of an authorities bundle. It starts with provisions from the Constitution. That's precisely it, Chair. Thank you. That's the first thing. And the other thing that I'd like to hand up is just proposed... Giving you homework precisely, Chair. It is copies of proposed draft wording for a public access provision that Amabongani suggests would be put in the bill. Now... Absolutely, just in case, I'm delighted to see that, though, Chair. The first point I'd like to make at the outset is really just that the two submissions that I'm going to be concentrating on are really in the alternative. And really what that means is if you agree with our first proposition, and I'll get into these in more detail shortly, but the first proposition is the committee should wait. It should wait until the commission is finished. It should consider the report, and thereafter it should look at the amendments to the bill. So that's the first proposition. If the committee is with us on that, then you wouldn't obviously include the public access provision at this stage. So the second, I just wanted to draw your attention to that. And
did you understand the explanation of a parliamentary process that I tried to explain?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I did, and I'm going to deal with those issues. I just wanted to make...
You've got 7 minutes left.
Perfect. So, Chair, given that the time is limited, what I wanted to do is really first just list the topics that I'm going to address. So the first one is just that the powers of Parliament. The second one is why wait? In other words, why wait until the Commission of Inquiry is finished? The third one is about the public access provision. And fourth, I'll touch on the draft wording that we've proposed. So I don't intend to repeat what's in the written submission, but there are various points that I'd like to emphasize. So the first point, just to emphasize, and we make the point on page 4 of their submission, is that the NCOP has very wide powers under the Constitution. And those powers are that it may amend, reject, approve the legislation from the NA. It's not merely a rubber stamp, of course. All of these detailed processes happen independently. And really what I'd like to emphasize there is that's precisely what is made out in the land access movement case. And we deal with this in detail in the written submission at pages 5 to 7. And there what was important is that the Concord emphasized that because the NCOP hadn't properly facilitated public involvement and hadn't provided a sufficient amount of time to give submissions and for those to be considered, the entire Parliament as a whole had failed in its constitutional duty to facilitate public involvement. There are just two points that I wanted to emphasize that aren't in the paragraphs we've cited. And that is, one of the points that the Concord made in that very case is that it referred to the number of bills that were being debated and the number of issues that were being determined in quick succession. And I just draw the committee's attention to paragraph 79 of that judgment. Now, the other point that I'd like to make is that one of the reasons that appears to be proffered, or it would seem so, is that the reason that the bill is being pressed forward is because the parliamentary term is about to end. Now, the Limosa case, the land access movement case, makes it absolutely clear that the fact that the bill might lapse when Parliament's term ends is no basis to proceed ahead with the bill. And what the court said there is that in the next term, the committee, the bill could just be reintroduced, and it's no basis for urgency, it's no basis for any process being truncated. And what Amabongani would like the commission to, what it would like to emphasize, is just that to the extent, and I'm not suggesting that this is the case, but to the extent that anyone were ever to review the parliamentary process, it would examine the NA's process and the NCOP's process differently, distinctly, and it would determine whether each process gave sufficient time. Now, I'd just like to refer you to one aspect of the submissions, and that's at page 7. Now, what Amabongane says there is that ordinarily, in between the time of the notice being published and the written submissions being put forward, there are other processes that take place. One of them is that these workshops between public interest organizations as well as the organizations with the public meet and highlight particular features of the bills. So we would submit that that is an important part of the public process that needed to be truncated in this particular instance because of the quick succession between the bill being approved by the NA, and we, as the chair pointed out, this is the bill that was the standing committee bill. So it's very different in many respects to the bill that was put forward as the private members bill a year or so ago. And what I'd like to emphasize is that it's tempting always to say, what difference would it have made? What points would have come out that haven't come out? And there I'd just like to refer the committee to page 24 of the authorities bundle, and it's at paragraph 46. There's a case there, it's an English case, but it's been referred to by the SCA numerous times. It's called John versus Rees. And essentially the point there, and I'll just read the quote briefly, is that as everybody who has anything to do with the law well knows, the path of law is strewn with examples of open and shut cases which somehow were not, of unanswerable charges which in the event were completely unanswered, of inexplicable conduct which was fully explained. And really that is a good reason, we submit, why the committee should first wait to see what happens with the report. And one of the points is that the allegations made in the committee before the PIC commission, we submit, form some part of the basis, the same allegations, the very reason for the amendments that have taken place. And if I could just refer the committee now to a media statement by Parliament on the 26th of February, and this is at page 31 of the authorities that I've handed up. And it says that the House approves the PRC bill, and the approval comes on the back of various allegations of wrongdoing and questionable investments levelled against the PRC. Now, what we've submitted in the written submissions is that given that these allegations are merely just that, they aren't findings, that's the very reason that the terms of reference for amendment to the Act and the precise nature of the amendments should only be determined after the findings have been made. So I've referred the committee to what's called the Shaburi case by the Supreme Court of Appeal. This is at page 17 of the authorities. And the court makes it clear that evidence must always be considered in its entirety. So we make two points. The first is all of the evidence, not just what's happened so far, but what will be found by the commission is relevant. And the second point is that should determine what amendments need to be put forward on the basis of those findings. Now, at page 81, there's a statement that is from Parliamentary Monitoring Group, and that is about the meeting that took place on the 6th of March, before this committee, as I understand it. And there were various points made by the members of the National Assembly who were present at the meeting, and I'd just like to deal with those, if I might. So the first point is that the point was made that the Commission of Inquiry is an executive structure. Its work would need to be processed by the executive, and the executive would then bring a bill to Parliament. That was unlikely to happen before August, and that was too long a gap, given all the work that had been done. Now, the point I'd like to emphasize is that one shouldn't conflate waiting for the report.
Sir, I've got everything here, what you are saying now. Here it is. The members got it.
Yes.
So you've got 2 minutes left.
This is a point that wasn't fleshed out fully in those submissions, Chair. But I appreciate the point. I'll be brief. The point is one shouldn't conflate waiting for the report and waiting for the executive to act thereafter. So in other words, what Amabungani submits is that amendments should be made on findings, not on allegations. And the committee or the Parliament need not wait for the executive to wait thereafter. The second point is that PMG report makes it clear, Mr. Karim apparently said, it would be foolhardy to dump the bill after all the hard work. Well, that's precisely what the Concord rejected in the land access movement case. You wouldn't be dumping the bill. You'd merely be delaying it for a couple of months. And the Concord in that very case said the mere fact that there's elections and Parliament would be inactive is not a reason to move hastily. Thank you, Chair. Then perhaps what I'll do is I'll move to the public access provision itself. Now, the point that we'd like to make is that another reason to wait, we say, is because there's a severe lack in the bill at present, and that is because of the submissions. I was going to take the committee through some of it, but I'm just going to highlight the testimony of Mr. Sini at page 11. He was the assistant portfolio manager of the PIC, as well as Mr. Jack's testimony that has been before the commission. There's extraordinary allegations which demonstrate in our submission that greater accountability is needed. And what we submit is that there ought to be, as a matter of routine, default access to for the public, and we submit if the chair has regard to the wording. Do you have it in front of you, Chair? Okay. Perfect. Yeah. This is. Yes, I understand, Chair. This is expanding on that. The point we really just make is that when the Constitutional Court considers whether a bill or an act is unconstitutional, it says, are there less restrictive means of achieving the purpose? And what we submit is that in its present form, it's too restrictive on access to information. So what we propose is draft wording, which includes classes of information that would be proactively disclosed publicly on the website. And the advantage of this proposed wording is that it leaves that process for another day. So in other words, all of that would be fleshed out in regulations that could later be published and could later be considered after a proper public process. Now, one of the points I'd just like to emphasize before I try and wrap up, Chair, is that...
You've got less than a second.
Less than a second, Chair. Thank
yes,
you very much.
You are not listening.
Yes. I'm indebted, Chair. So just the very last point. I'd just like to refer the committee to page 78 of the authorities bundle. And what is there is the California Public Employees Retirement System. Essentially, it's the American carbon copy of the PIC. And just, committee and Chair, if one has regard to how open their process is, there's access to vast amounts of information. And we submit that because the PIC is using vast amounts of ultimately it's an organ of state, public funds, it should be made to disclose further information. Chair, unless there are further questions, those are the submissions, but I would ask the committee to have regard to the written submissions as well as the authorities that we've handed up.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. The Association of Black Securities and Investment Professionals. There you are, sir. Welcome. Seeing that the previous presenters took 22 minutes, I'm going to give you 22 minutes. Advocate Jenkins will prepare himself to also respond in terms of processes referring to legislation, etc. He's an expert on that. You may proceed.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to present here. I represent the Association of Black Securities and Investment Professionals. We have presented to you in 2016 to your committee in Gauteng, yes. And last year we also presented to the relevant committee on lack of transformation in the financial sector. We do appreciate that opportunity. That's fine. APSIP was started in 1995 to address the lack of representation of black professionals in the securities and investment industry. And it's evolved into also representing black business in the financial sector. I just want to just to follow on our presentations we've made, as I said, in 2016 and 2017. I just want to show you this specific slide here, and it's a picture of a conference that's happening in April. It's to independent financial service, independent financial advisors. It's quite a big conference, both in Cape Town and Johannesburg. And there's on that picture there, you'll notice it's clear on that one, but hopefully clear on this one here. There's about 48 people speaking there. And if you look at that 48 people, you'll see, if you want to take a guess, there are only four black people out of the 48 people there. And these are key decision makers at this conference in South Africa, and only six of them are female. Just to reiterate, you know, that the industry, if you look at the real decision makers, hasn't really transformed. We're nearly 25 years into democracy, and it reinforces the point I made in 2016 and in 2017 at the hearings at Parliament, and something needs to be done about it. And the reason why I bring this in this specific instance is because we need to also acknowledge the role of the Public Investment Corporation in that they have helped significantly in incubating and growing black asset management firms in the country. So we need to recognize it and thank the Public Investment Corporation for that specifically. Just in regard to board appointments, and that's what this amendment is about in introducing a couple of new appointments. And this goes for any company, whether it's a listed company, private sector company, or any state-owned enterprise. It's independent directors, non-executive independent directors have to be fiercely independent, act with the utmost integrity, promote and upkeep the integrity of the PIC, and more importantly, they've got to safeguard the assets and the pension for the pension fund beneficiaries. And as you know, the government employees pension fund, which the PIC manages assets for, is a defined benefit fund. Ultimately, we as taxpayers are the backstop if there's a deficit in the fund. So it's very important that they look after the assets and we get very good risk-adjusted returns over a period of time. The other thing that this committee must consider is that the King Code allows for 9 independent executive directorship positions. We're saying, and we've made the submission to the King Code and the Institute of Directors in 2016, and we said to them, you need to limit it to just 4 positions because people don't really have the time to look at 9 positions of companies over a period of time. But more important, we need to introduce diversity and we need to break this elbow network club, because what they tend to do is they tend to have just the same people on a number of listed company directorships. And we're not talking of only listed companies, we're also referring to unlisted company positions or entities where it might not be a company, it might be a trust or any other entity. We also ask that the independent non-executive directors must be more than at least 50% of the board of the PIC, must have good investment experience in investment management firms and investments. No board member should have any conflict of interest in any of the PIC investments or transactions. And if there is a conflict of interest, they should immediately resign. They could possibly recuse themselves, but that also creates problems on its own. We encourage when you're appointing members of the PIC is comprehensive probity checks. The reason why we specifically highlight that is that the PIC manages a big pot of assets and it's seen as easy money for all these so-called helpers and deal makers. And we talk these corporate financiers, people trying to start businesses, they're trying to sell an idea and they're trying to raise money. So it's very important that you have people that are experienced, that know that's what's happening, they've been on the other side, to actually be appointed to this board and have the key skills and experience. Experience is probably very important here. When it comes to recruitment of investment professionals, and they need to be highly skilled, appropriately qualified, and persons with integrity and honesty. I've had many experiences in this myself. Personally, I work for a large life assurer. We manage quite a lot of assets. I started off as an analyst of unlisted securities, eventually become chief investment officer. And I've seen many people coming through our doors there, and the one guy specifically I remembered, he told me straight to my face, how am I going to take the money off you? He had absolutely no shame when it comes to these type of, entities. I've seen people come there with ideas that's not workable, that's not going to work at all, to the extent that they call you at home and they try and put pressure in you to take money off you. And we've got to be very careful because we, at that instance, was managing money for policyholders, and it just happened to be at that point in time, a lot of the policyholder beneficiaries were black people, and we had to look after their money and to make sure that we get a good return on it. The other amendment that you've put through, that you're proposing, is the reporting of valuations of investments, both listed and unlisted investments. As I said earlier on, it's a defined benefit fund. Ultimately, taxpayers are liable. It's in the public interest that investments get disclosed. We're saying that it should be done on a biannual basis instead of an annual basis. and it should be published on the website of the Public Investment Corporation 3 months after the biannual reporting date. What for unlisted investments, it's important that they also put a brief valuation basis. What was the basis in terms of the valuation that they, how they determined the valuation? It might be a price earnings multiple, might be a discounted cash flow, with key assumptions mentioned there. The other important thing that also that to increase their transparency is to when they do this publication every 6 months on a biannual basis, is to actually give the historic returns of the actual underlying assets that the PIC manage. And it's for 6 months, 1 month, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, 15 and 20 years to publish. You can, and it must be compared to relevant benchmarks. And what I mean there, if you're looking at equities only, the performance of equities, listed equities, you need to compare it to an appropriate benchmark that's published by the GSE. If it's unlisted equities, it's going to be compared to an appropriate benchmark, and there it might be a peer group, for example, published by the private equity funds in South Africa, how they've performed, you can compare that to that. So it's important that you compare to relevant benchmarks. The last slide here is talking about BBB owners, triple broad-based black economic empowerment, and as APSIP we support broad-based black economic empowerment instead of the focus on narrow B enrichment, as we call it. There's nothing wrong with people getting rich in the individual capacity, but here in this case what we're saying is that the South Africans must share in the wealth and income of the assets in South Africa. It should be ultimately what we should be doing is when it comes to broad-based black economic empowerment, the target should be gender demographics and race demographics. That ultimately should be the target. Because at the moment, the targets that we've got in the broad-based black economic empowerment act is far too low. It's way off. For example, ownership is 25%, while black people constitute nearly 90% of the population. Mandated investments such as the Public Investment Corporation or the GEPF, Government Employees Pension Fund, you've got to look through and say what is the, if you might call it, what percentage do black people own of those assets? What percentage do women own of those assets? And you've got to look through and you've got to say, then companies can take a credit for broad-based black economic empowerment in the ownership element of the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act. But the point we're trying to make is before you do that, you need to reset the targets to closely reflect population demographics and specifically race and gender. We also, as APSIP is saying, that we need to abolish this whole concept or notion of once empowered, always empowered. It's known as also called the continuing consequences principle. We think it's the words is just sugarcoating it. What it effectively says is to black people, imagine you've owned a share when you don't really own a share. That's in reality what it is about. We're saying that we should remove it from all broad-based black economic empowerment legislation. With regard to amending the bill, you've got a bill here. If you don't amend it now, these are considerations that you need to take, because after the commission, you'll probably really look at the Public Investment Commissioner Act as such, and then you will probably need to take these into account, and we would more than welcome an opportunity to present at that point in time. Thanks very much, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, sir, for your presentation. On the members, we will now move to Kusatu. That's here since 9:30 this morning, and they're still here. Welcome again. Giving you also your 22 minutes. Just before they start, honourable members, why are we conducting this year the Multi-Party Whips Committee and the Multi-Party Program Committee took a decision that this bill be on the program of the National Council of Provinces. And in terms of that programming meeting and WIPS meeting, we are proceeding with what we are doing. And we can only stop this process if those two structures review their decision and give an instruction to the committee. That's a parliamentary process. You won't find it elsewhere outside of this precinct. I want to make it very clear. Because there were actions taken the last 24 hours to try and stop this process. And in terms of the structures of Parliament, we are proceeding as we are doing today. Kusatu, welcome. Please present.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair, and to colleagues who have joined us since this morning. My name is Matthew Parks from the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and I'm joined by my colleague, Comrade Tony Ehrenreich. Chair, I think we, as COSATU, we're very pleased with the words you have just uttered. As COSATU, as our 16 affiliates, our almost 2 million members, we are extremely angry about what's happening at the PIC. I think we're quite furious at attempts by various parties to collapse the PIC bill over the last 2 years. Chair, I think it's important to remember what is the PIC? It's not government money. It's not the fiscus. It's not taxpayers' money. It's the GEPF, that's the Government Employees Pension Fund. It's the Unemployment Insurance Fund, which workers contribute every month in the salary deductions. It's the Compensation of Injury on Duty Fund. What we've seen over the past few years is that everybody seems to view this as some sort of petty cash to loot. It's some sort of a fiscus to fund the state, which is collapsing. It's some sort of way to make money, to become rich. Chair, it's there to take care of pensioners, public servants, when they retire, that they're taken care of in old age. It's there when workers are injured on duty, they're taken care of. When workers are retrenched by companies, they've got some sort of money. So it's not just any funds. Comrade Chair, as COSATU and our affiliates, we strongly support this bill. In fact, we're unashamedly here today to defend this bill. We are very pleased with the work that the Standing Committee of Finance has done on it. They've done a fantastic job. They made us proud. They've approached us in a very methodical, detailed way. It's fantastic work, Chair. You will never find a bill which is a Mona Lisa, perfect, beautiful, but you get a reasonable compromise as you can within the political parameters, the time frames, etc. Chair, I think it's also important to note that the PIC is not just any fund. It's the largest investment fund, not just in the country, but the continent. It is worth 12.5% of the JSE. It has shares in almost every listed company in this country. So, Chair, we're not speaking as if this is Switzerland. We're in the height of state capture. If the PIC goes the route of Eskom, SAA, or SABC, we are finished as a nation. Even the IMF will not be able to save us, Chair. So simply put, it is too big to be allowed to fail. And we don't think we're being alarmist as COSATU to say there are serious problems. That's why the President correctly appointed the PIC Commission of Inquiry to try to bring light to what's going on in the PIC. Chair, as I said, this is a bill that COSATU strongly supports. We hope that on the 20th of March, when we issue a press statement, we can celebrate the passage of this bill, Chair. Chair, sorry, technology must catch up with me sometimes. Chair, maybe just a bit of background to the context of the PIC bill. As we all know, there's been a massive looting across the state. I think we've all seen in the past few years journalists doing fantastic work exposing serious allegations of corruption in the PIC. The President wouldn't have appointed the Commission if there were not serious problems there. And, Chair, this has a massive impact upon workers. Right now, we are seeing numerous SOEs on the verge of collapse. The people to suffer will be workers who will be retrenched. You have Eskom, where government wants to retrench possibly 30,000 workers. SABC wants to retrench 3,000 workers. The Minister of Finance said we must close on SAA, despite it employing 12,000 people. So this is a real threat to workers' livelihoods. We have seen government being forced to increase taxes to manage the crisis of looting. Again, it's hitting workers. We're now seeing numerous attempts to say the PIC, can you invest across the SOEs? So, Chair, this has a real impact upon workers. Workers have also borne the brunt of corruption. We've seen a fidentia, what happened to workers' pension money. It was gone. One person went to prison for a little while. At Transnet, Chair, you will know that every year you get pensioners who used to work for Transnet 20 years ago coming to Parliament pleading for the money. That money has been chowed. Chair, we have representation as Labour on the GEPF and UAF and COIDO boards, but our representatives on those boards struggle to get a meaningful report from the PIC to them. They read about dubious investments in the newspapers. When they get reports, it's long after the fact, and they don't see the real skeletons in the closet there. So it's clearly there's a breakdown in trust. Chair, we also got a wake-up call as COSATU in our September 2017 Central Executive Committee, where Comrade Malusi Gigaba, when he was then Minister of Finance, told us verbatim he cannot guarantee that he won't use the PIC to bail out the SOEs. And when you're talking about Eskom having a 420 billion rand debt, which is ballooning, all the SOE debt is about 600 billion rand. Yet other ministers like Comrade Motsoaledi, the Minister of Higher Education, say we need to use the PIC to fund NHI, fund tertiary education. If we were to take that route, the PIC will collapse. We'll have no pensions for our workers. So, Chair, that is when we started to engage with the Standing Committee of Finance to say, look, things are not going well. We need to intervene now before it's too late. The Standing Committee had, as you mentioned, drafted two bills. One is a DA bill, which was rejected by the Standing Committee and by the National Assembly. Then there was the bill drafted by the ANC and passed by the Standing Committee on Finance and by the National Assembly. Chair, we hear what Amar Bongani is saying, but it wants to also state on the record that there have been extensive public participation processes. The first draft of the bill was ready about 2 years ago. The Standing Committee on Finance has really set a new bar for public participation. They had more than four or five public hearings. Everybody was involved in that. Treasury, the PIC, the GPF, Amar Bongani, COSATU, FODUSA. It really has been the most open process of any committee bill. They systematically addressed the concerns of everybody, including Treasury, the PIC, etc. Unions were involved in it on a detailed basis. And I must also say, Chair, that we also as COSATU were forced to make many compromises and concessions as part of the give and take of negotiations. So we didn't get a blank check around it. Many times Yunus Karim would phone me just to shout at me and swear at me that I must compromise, and we did. Chair, I want also maybe to go back to say, why do we need a bill? The PIC Act, and I'm hoping everybody has read it, it governs a 2 trillion rand fund, right? It's 4.5 pages long. The Broadcasting Act, which governs SABC, which is worth 2 billion rand, is about 34 pages. It's actually incredulous that this bill, this act, which was drafted in 2004, is 4.5 pages. It's very, very thin, Chair, and I think it's part of the reason why we've seen rampant looting at the PIC. So it allows the minister to appoint the PIC board, minimal checks and balances, there's no representation for workers, those workers' money. The minister can issue any directive to the PIC as long as it's reasonable and in the public interest, which we've seen can mean anything under the sun. And nowadays we can't simply rely upon that finance ministers are people above reproach. We had one situation where we had three finance ministers in 1 week, as you might recall, not so long ago. Chair, in the PIC Act, there are no transparency and there are no accountability provisions. Again, this is quite shocking given the size. There's no requirements for getting a mandate from the depositors. There's no investment guidelines. Simply put, Chair, the PIC Act is a huge problem. The fact that it's still there, it's a massive crisis. Chair, as COSATU, we support the PIC Amendment Bill wholeheartedly. It provides maybe, let's say, four key aspects which are needed right now to address the governance crisis in the PIC. One, it says that the minister will appoint the chair of the board. Right now, the act doesn't dictate that. The bill will provide for either the deputy minister of finance to chair it, or if not, for whatever reason, another deputy minister from the economic cluster in consultation with cabinet. And look, Chair, when this bill originally was drafted, three deputy ministers of finance ago. That's how long this bill's been in the process. We were worried that about the deputy minister having a conflict of interest in the PIC because of a relative getting money. But we listened to the ANC, and the ANC motivated that there's a need for the deputy minister of finance to chair it because the GPF is a defined benefit. So if there's a shortfall, the fiscus must cover it. So we appreciated that argument. We also appreciated the argument of the ANC that there's a huge economic transformation role of the PIC in the economy. We accepted that. And I think lastly, Chair, we accepted the ANC argument that the need for political accountability and oversight, it must be the DM who chairs it. It can't be a minister because the minister can't account to himself. The PIC accounts to the minister. So, Chair, in the give and take of compromise in the spirit of negotiations, we accepted the ANC's argument and we found logic to it. Chair, it's not a guarantee that if you have an external chairperson, that external chairperson won't misbehave. We've seen it at SAA, SABC, ESCOM, many other parastatal boards, where you've had so-called independent chairpersons who've actually driven those SOEs into the ground. At least with a deputy minister, you can call them to the standing committee or the select committee of finance. You can call them to parliament to account. It's very difficult to call other independent persons to account. And you need to maximize accountability, Chair. Chair, another reason why we support this bill is that, again, this is workers' money. It's not money which fell out of the sky. The bill corrects a current problem with the Act. Currently, there are no worker representatives on the PIC board. The bill provides for 3 union reps on the board of 13. This gives the workers a voice in how the money is spent. It gives them eyes to see how it's being spent. For us, it's a key anti-corruption, a key oversight measure. We had long discussions with the ANC about it. In the beginning, we had to fight to convince the members why we needed union representation. We were offered one rep appointed by the minister. We didn't want one rep appointed by the minister because the minister can take his friend, a leader of a union of 200 people, easily manipulable, can give him some money, he'll be happy. We said it must be workers who appoint their representatives. So you have the Public Service Bargaining Council that is established by law, the statutory body. It covers all public service workers. Because the majority of this fund is by public service workers, we argue that it must be the PSCBC which selects these 3 union reps in proportion to the membership. So not a question of COSATU because you're friends of the ANC. So 2 will come from the majority unions in the PSCBC, 1 would come from the minority unions. And we chose it deliberately because we also want to build unity amongst workers. So you'd have 2 from COSATU, for example, right now. We'd have 1 from FEDUSA. But also, Chair, we wanted 3 so they can also police each other because it's easy to bribe somebody. We've had experience in the past around that. We don't want to trust people. We want to have maximum oversight around it. Chair, we were asked in the standing committee discussions that they don't want to bring myself or Comrade Tony because they've got no asset management experience. We were happy that whatever the requirements are for the PIC board members, they must also be applied to the union reps. So if you want a person with a master's degree in asset management, it's fine. We'll supply those persons, Chair. Chair, I think we must also say that as COSATU, we compromise significantly. The norm in the private sector around pension fund boards is 50-50 representation, 50% employer, 50% employee. We compromise here to say, okay, we'll accept 3 out of the 13 reps as a reasonable compromise. I think, Chair, we must also realize that COSATU is the one who's saying we must keep the GPF in the PIC. FEDUSA has said they are done with corruption, they want to pull out. If you can pull the GPF out of the PIC, you might as well close it tomorrow because that is 87% of it. And we say that precisely because you can get more accountability through Parliament over a PIC and also the important transformational role of the PIC. Chair, also around the issues of transparency and accountability, the bill brings the PIC into line with other acts. So it says regulations should be tabled or must be tabled at Parliament for noting and commenting, not for approval, but just simply for noting and commenting for scrutiny, which is important because often the heart of the issue of an act is in the regulations. If Parliament doesn't comment, it's fine, but at least they must be given the chance to note and to comment. It brings transparency. This is the normal act of practice amongst legislation. Chair, it also requires that the PIC must table annual reports to Parliament through the minister responsible. That's the finance minister. And there was huge fights and discussions around this, Chair, for months. It must include all investments listed on the stock exchange and unlisted. Amazingly, Chair, in the beginning, the PIC didn't want to do either. They said, well, if you list unlisted investments, there'll be manipulation of stock market value, speculation, all of that. The balance in the bill is reasonable. As part of the annual report, you must disclose all listed investments. And there's no reason to not do that. The JSC provides that. But the public needs to be able to see, the members of Parliament need to be able to see where the investments going. Chair, there was huge fights around unlisted investments. That's worth about 10% of the PIC, which is about 200 billion rand. And that's where we suspect the real looting is taking place. It took the Deputy Minister at that time, Kabisi Jonas, to intervene to instruct the PIC to report to Parliament on all unlisted investments. And surely if you're doing the public funds, it can't be an argument. This day and age in democracy, this extent of looting in the state. Chair, also what the bill does, which is very important, it requires the PIC to report to Parliament through the Minister in the annual report on all ministerial directives to the PIC. Right now, there's no such requirement. So literally, I as a minister can say, PIC must give Comrade Charles de Beer 200 million rand to open KFC. And we've seen that kind of looting reported in the media, Chairperson, so we're not being alarmist. Or chicken licking. Chair, there's also been huge attacks against the bill saying that we're interfering with the depositors' mandates. And that is devoid of all truth. In fact, on this slide, we have copied and pasted in italics and quotation marks the exact wording of the bill, where it's very clear, crystal clear, that PIC must get the mandate when investing from the depositors. It must invest to the benefit of those depositors. It must invest to ensure the security and the financial sustainability of the depositors' investments. So in simple English, its mandate comes from the GPF, from the UAF, from the COIDA. It must protect those investments. That's sacrosanct. That is also why we push for it, because, Chair, we couldn't explain to our workers, Nahau, Denosa, etc., why would their pension money be going to bail out dubious projects? So why is it going to very dubious investments, Chairperson? Chair, again, we've copy and pasted in the investment guidelines verbatim from the bill, deliberately, then guidelines for PIC investments. And it's been worded very carefully by the Standing Committee on Finance to say the PIC want to invest must seek as far as possible to promote the following criteria, as you can see here. Financial sustainability, job creation, economic development, sustainable development, like with this morning's carbon tax, prioritize investments in the Republic, developmental state, all the normal issues. So, Chair, it's carefully worded to say as far as possible seek. So not overwhelming to the PIC. So it doesn't bind them in a corner, for example, if they can't meet those criteria. But it's stuff they should pursue, they should seek to achieve where possible. And you'll see in bold, we've also put all, so you don't have to meet all the criteria. And that is chosen deliberately, so we're not accused of imposing prescribed asset management, etc., etc. So none of these words were chosen by accident, Chairperson. But we don't think it should be a problem, because the PIC, when they report to Parliament, they always say that they try to meet these very objectives. So if that's what they do, why would it give anybody a heart attack to put it there? And this is the norm, Chair. These are critical for our investment in the growth of the economy, Comrade Chair. Chair, I must be very honest, maybe let me apologize to you, Comrade Chair, and to members for being brutally honest today. I've never seen the kind of resistance to a bill that I've seen of this bill from day one. It's never in the committee meeting. It's always behind the scenes, a phone call, an email, an SMS from people who don't even participate in the committee, trying to collapse the bill at all costs. This is why we're so keen for the bill to be passed. And Chair, it's basically three types of resistance or groups. Number one, we think, is those who are looting the PIC, who have looted and who want to continue looting. Those who benefit from the governance chaos of the PIC. And again, Chair, go to the PIC Commission to see examples of that kind of looting. Chair, we've seen the DA and COPE and two other small opposition parties voting against an NA. Sure, that's their right in a democracy. We disagree with them. And we'll be sure to let our members know how parties voted on the bill, Chair. But that's their right. Chair, we've also been quite alarmed and disappointed to see Treasury officials who participated throughout the process in the Standing Committee of Finance. On the one hand, on the other hand, you've got some Treasury officials consistently seeking to collapse the bill, to undermine every single clause of the bill. So we try to understand what is the reason for this massive covert resistance. Never in the face, never in the Standing Committee, always behind the scenes. Letters are written and so on. So there's some arguments that, well, the chair shouldn't be the deputy minister, which is strange because that's the ANC stance. It's strange also to hear from Treasury officials they don't want to have worker representation on the PIC board. Again, this is workers' money. It's a norm in the private sector. Amazingly, some people in the PIC didn't want to report on listed or unlisted investments. They were not keen to be bound to be taking the mandates of the depositors, and for some weird reason, they don't support investment guidelines. So that's the strange things. Chair, we think in a nutshell, you can put it to two issues. One is that those who are looting want to continue looting. They view this as an anti-corruption bill which will disrupt the looting. I'm not sure what must we say to them, Chair. Then we think, Chair, that we don't believe Treasury is corrupt. We think Treasury is led by officials with integrity. They played a key role in fighting corruption, protecting the state. But we think simply they are irritated to see an assertive parliament. Remember, Chair, that your committee and the Standing Committee of Finance have done good work in this term of providing for engagement and forcing Treasury to engage with business and labour at NEDLAC on retirement annuities, sugar tax, the carbon tax, VAT. Treasury's never wanted to engage in this thing. So we think simply, Chair, maybe they don't want to see an assertive parliament. Chair, we understand the Commission of Inquiry to the PIC has written to Parliament, to the Speaker, on the eve of the NA passing the bill, saying stop the bill. And I think, Chair, we must make the point that that will be a very dangerous precedent if we allow it. One is preempting the Commission's outcome. The Commission might say there's no need to amend the Act. Chair, the Commission also is not a judicial, it's not a court of law. It's appointed by the Executive, it's accountable to the Executive. It's an extension of the Executive, and the Executive cannot undermine the constitutional role of Parliament. That's very clear. We cannot allow Parliament to be undermined. Chair, this is a committee bill, as you said. It's not an Executive bill. It's not accountable to the Executive. And ministers cannot dictate to Parliament what to do with the committee bill. Chair, we do respect the Commission of Inquiry, but we've requested to make a submission there. Orderly, we've already done a written one. We look forward to them enriching the Act down the road, and they're welcome to do it. They can come with an amendment bill at any time. We would welcome it. And Chair, look, Parliament and Treasury in particular amends legislation every year. This will be nothing different. But Chair, we've also been asked, what's the rationale? And the rationale, Chair, is that the GEPF has projected to have a shortfall of 25 billion rand. Hardly a day goes past without the newspapers of all media houses reporting on serious allegations of the PIC corruption. We can't afford delay. You know, the average bill takes about 5 years to come to light. We've already spent 2 years just in the committee bill. How much longer must workers really wait, Chairperson? Chair, I'm going to try to come to that because I know I'm abusing my time limits a bit. I think I've come to the issue of the resistance of to the PIC bill, Chair. But maybe, Chair, it's also important to say, and look, we respect the Treasury and its officials' integrity, but we need to say that it is under the watch of Treasury, as a shareholder department, that we've seen misgovernance of the PIC, we've seen mass looting. There was no Tom Mayani appointed to the PIC. Most of the management of PIC comes from Treasury. It was Treasury which drafted the PIC Act in 2004, not so long ago, a four-page act. And I must also say, Chairs, Kosato, we're quite disappointed. We, over the past 2 years, have written to Treasury several times, to the Minister, to the Deputy Ministers, to engage with us as Kosato, as workers. At best, we get told telephonically, let's engage, comrades, let's engage. But we never have those meetings. Yet we've seen officials of Treasury running very enthusiastically to collapse this bill, Chair. So, Chair, in conclusion, we see two way forwards. One, we can kill this anti-corruption bill, and that can come in the guise of amendments, rejection, delays, collapsing the quorum, and that will simply give a green light to let looting and anarchy continue. And I'm also saying, Comrade Chair, as Kosato, that will be a massive political fallout for us, for the ANC and government. We will not be able to explain to our workers, our pensioners, why are we delaying such an important anti-corruption bill? Or, Chair, we can do the correct thing. We can pass the bill. We can leave the amendments for the next elections when the PIC Commission is ready. It will help to accelerate the fight against corruption. It will help to stabilize and clean up the PIC, Chairperson. So, Chair, yeah, I don't think I need to go into the conclusion anymore. But I think, Chair, we want to see on the 20th of March this bill be passed without bullying the members. And, Chair, I know in the NCP it's a big issue about the National Assembly taking time on bills and then dumping them on the NCP at the last minute. In fact, Chair, we raised this issue with the MPs in September last year, that the Standing Committee needs to get done with the bill to give space for the NCP to do its work. Unfortunately, there was, as part of it, as I was saying, some hidden resistance to even delaying the National Assembly from concluding this matter, Chair. So, Chair, I'm going to stop there and hope that we have assisted you, but really to say this is not an ordinary bill for Kosato members. It's a matter of life and death in the fight against corruption, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Kosato. Honourable members, I plead that members don't leave. You were very disciplined. Please, please don't leave. Treasury is here. I'm going to allow Treasury also to do their presentation. And then we can deliberate, and Advocate Jenkins will also come in on processes.
Thank you very much, Chair. I haven't been part of the process to date, but I have been asked to speak on behalf of the Treasury on this matter.
And Advocate von Square.
And Advocate von Square.
Yeah. Why are you sitting so far?
It's not our bill, Chair. It's the committee bill. Yes, so we've had a very constructive process, I think, as everybody has highlighted with the committee. Obviously, committee bills are quite a rare event for us, but I think it's been very constructive. We've raised issues, and I think we've dealt with almost all the issues, and so I think we're generally okay with the bill as it is. Our minister has written a letter, obviously, to the committee. I didn't draft the letter, but he is concerned about two issues, two outstanding issues. The first, I think, relates to the governance question about whether or not a political office bearer should be the chair of the PIC. The minister is concerned about that. And the second issue is just he has received a letter from Judge Mpati from the commission, and the judge has highlighted the fact that they are considering the governance issues around the board, and that the judge has asked that those are taken into account during the process. I think we've had a long engagement between the Treasury and the committee on the composition of the board, and we don't want to relitigate those issues. But just to say that obviously the commission is considering the appropriate governance structure of the board at the moment. And they have written to the Minister of Finance to ask that they be allowed to complete their work on that. I mean, that's just, I think, what they have proposed. I think that's the sum total of our submission on the bill.
Has
it
good
from
Squirt? No. Thank you. Questions, honourable members? Advocate Jenkins is here. He's our legal person. He's also being assisted. Honourable Monakedi? Okay. Yes?
Oh, the breakfast, lunch, are they gone?
Yeah,
like. Oh, okay. No, because I wanted a clarity on their presentation. If they are gone, I don't need to raise the matter. The second one from me is regarding a submission that was sent by Arthur Muloto. He once served in this committee in the National Assembly, and presently he's the chair of the Land Bank. There is somewhere in his submission where he is alluding to clause 2C of the bill, which directs the minister to appoint a board consisting of representatives of depositors, department, and registered unions. He has an issue with this particular clause because as far as he's concerned, it's like a stakeholder type of a board is now being established. But for me, I want the National Treasury to also then comment on what he says further in his submission, that the key requirement or one of the key requirements of the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act is that people who get appointed at that level, that is of the board, should be fit and proper persons. So the question is, if you are going to have a board representing those areas that I've alluded to, the department, trade unions and what have you, how do you make sure that they are also fit and proper? If I could get a comment, especially for the National Treasury. Thank you.
Anyone else? Blackfurst, Landfurst is back in the room, so you can put your question. There are the lady there at the back. Yeah, there's the leadership.
Ah, okay, leadership of the Blackfurst, Landfurst. And I just want to check, I was listening very intently to your presentation. And I do understand the socio-economic, political sort of background that you gave. But I was waiting as well for your precise input regarding the bill itself, you know, whether there are areas of concern that you think the committee should look at, or whether overall you are happy with it, with the bill. So I just want them to come back and just clarify that part. I'm saying the background in terms of social, economic, whatever. I think that those are very clear to me. But I want them to just clarify their position regarding the bill itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mamakiri. Any other member to put a question? None. Can you please come to the mic? Land first. And after that, Treasury. Now, I don't know if you can reply to Mr. Malotu's input, but you can try. Yes, sorry. Proceed.
Yes. We went through the bill as Black First, Land First, and as a movement, we are not entirely opposed to the idea of transparency in terms of how the public investment corporation is run, and in terms of diversity in the decision making as per the suggestions that have been put forward in the bill, particularly that if the part of the mandate of the public investment corporation is to manage the government employment pension fund, then there must be a composition, whether it's from a board level or from at a level of advisory, where the voice of the workers must be heard, and that the parliament as an institution where decision making happens, therefore plays a central role in recommending what the composition of the PIC should be. But I think what we are putting forward as Black First, Land First really is that all of these processes cannot happen without the bill putting it out clear that the public investment corporation does work within an environment where we are in a country where businesses is in the hands of a minority, and therefore we have not seen a proactive stance from the side of the PAC to do business to aid and promote what we may call radical economic transformation. We have not seen as part of the bill a clear commitment in terms of this money that is worth trillions, that all belongs to the black majority within the country. How is it going to be managed in a way where it is invested in institutions that can safeguard the interests of the people? What is currently happening now is that the money of the people is invested to white monopoly capital, and white monopoly capital in the country plays a role where they actively sabotage the government so that they may capture every aspect of government and therefore directly influence decision making. And we have seen this in how state-owned enterprises, particularly the likes of Eskom and the South African Airways, are being deliberately collapsed so as to allow the private sector that is dominated by a particular race, which is white in this country, which wants to do things in a manner that is anti the majority of the people. So we would have loved with Black First, Land First to see a clear commitment from the bill in terms of how is the work of the PIC going to be reconstituted in such a way that the mandate of the PIC and making sure that the people whose money, whose hard-earned wealth is invested in a way that the country benefits, and the money of the people is not managed in a way where the South African corporations, which is white monopoly capital, benefit, gets direct investment from the public investment corporation, but we are sitting with a scenario where white monopoly capital is sitting on billions, if not almost a trillion of rent today, where they refuse to invest debt into the economy of the country, and we believe as Black First Lancers that equals to sabotage.
You done?
Yes, I'm done.
Just put off your mic. Yes, sir, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to add one thing to that. Just today, we got the information that Group 5 is under business review. PIC owns 21% in that. The effect of how PIC functions as a determining factor on the workers. This is one of the big five construction companies in the country. So as the Deputy President of PLF was saying, yes, we can talk to transparency and overseeing, but if we don't go to the heart of the problem of investing in black business, speaking to audit managers and so forth, we will maintain a problem that sees Group 5 running the construction cartel and losing government pensions. And that's the heart of the message from BLF. Thank you.
Thank you, Treasury.
Thank
you, Mr. Maloto.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, MP can speak to this point, but I think Mr. Maloto makes the point that it's very important that members of the board should be fit and proper. And obviously we would support that. As you know, in the Financial Sector Regulation Act, we have a whole procedure for determining what is fit and proper. And I think that maybe links to the Minister's point about how we go about appointing particularly the Chair. I mean, I think that was also highlighted in the AFSA presentation that you do want a level of independence involved. I don't know if you've got anything.
Chair, doesn't in the PIC Act currently, Section 6.3, which is not amended, it's stated that members of the board must be appointed on the grounds of their knowledge and experience and with due regard to the financials, the FIES Act that is referenced by the submission, which must be considered collectively should enable the board to obtain its objectives. So those requirements are still, and it will apply to all members of the board, including the union representatives, the chairperson, that they, so in order for them to still be licensed as a FIES service provider.
Thank you, Advocate Roskoor. Advocate Monekeri.
I think it will be interesting to hear from COSATU on the same matter. Sure, and I see. No, I think I see Fumbert Mithi wants to say something. I'm just saying, I think it will be interesting to hear their point of view on this.
Comrade Eisenrig and Comrade Park.
No, thanks, Comrade Chair. So, no, look, I think to respond to Honorable Monekeri, look, first, the PIC is not an ordinary body. It's not the board of a zoo or a university council. It manages workers' money. And workers are very alarmed by the amount of looting in the state. They want to have a say on how the money is spent. They want to have a voice when in board meetings to know what's going on. This is the norm across the private sector, where it's always employee and employees are there. And clearly the system right now is not working properly. Otherwise there would be no commission of inquiry right now set up by the president. So first, Chair, also this is about the issue of rebuilding trust. Workers no longer trust the state and how the money is managed. That's why you have fiduciaries saying, for example, let's pull out of the PIC. So we need to rebuild that trust, Chair. Chair, we need to stop the issue of looting, because if we can allow the PIC to go the route of Eskom or SABC, even the IMF can't save us. We'll be finished as a nation. It'll take us years to recover. Chair, we're very happy to say whatever the fit and proper requirements are in the Act, apply them to our guys. We don't want to send our guys and let them blunder. They must also be held to the same high standards. If they mess up, they must be removed. We'll create that 200% because this is workers' money. It's not a question of friendship. It's pensioners' money. But I think, Chairman, why we also want the bill now is because the Act is so thin. It basically gives a blank check to the Minister to establish the board. All he has to do right now is to take into account the nominations of depositors, consult Cabinet, which can mean anything. And we've seen, Chair, in the board which resigned that there was a relative, a niece, I believe, or as a report in the media, of a senior politician sitting on the board. So you kind of, you really need to have maximum security, maximum scrutiny over this process. And our workers feel that this is their money, they need to have a voice on the table. Not to loot, but to ensure good governance, Comrade Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Covered, Honorable Manakedi. Advocate Jenkins, you and your team.
Chair, I'm not 100% sure what you want us to respond to. I can go through the submissions. We're unfortunately, for me, I'm out of time. I've got a personal thing to attend to, but I can deal with one or two things. If you indulge, I mean, one of the things that has come up twice was the qualifications of the directors, which Treasury has taken care of. This is an amendment bill, so the Act, the PIC Act, is still there. That takes care of that, and it's a reference to the Fires Act. So when you amend the Fires Act, you amend the qualifications. Well, you're dealing then with the qualifications of the directors also on the PIC board. The number of directors which was raised, that is a policy issue. I mean, it may be as many as 13, as indicated. I think the PIC, being a sort of specific type of institution, state-owned company that's doing investments on behalf of government, needs to be taken into consideration. But yes, the King Code, number 4, I think it is now, does say that it applies to government. So it applies to government, but 9 is a recommendation there, so it's not completely off the radar. Chair, a lot was said about the way that investments are done. Of course, this bill doesn't deal with that, except that we're giving guidelines, which actually deals with some of these issues, speaking about industrialization, sustainable development, the developmental state, etc. So I think there's some echoes of that issue in there. But what I've heard from the majority of the submissions is that there's concern, both with the way it's invested as well as the returns. I mean, there was a point made by the Association of Black Securities and Investment Professionals about benchmarking. Now, I think that's the, I'm not sure, I may be overshooting the limit or hitting above my salary grade, but the issue is that we're doing an analysis of investment. Is that the investment company that must do it themselves? I think there's a conflict of interest. In other words, PIC can't publish investment analysis of how good it is to investors. I mean, that will shake the market. I think during the standing committee deliberations, there were some issues about the effect transparency has on the markets. So you have to strike a balance between what Amo Bugane is advocating for, to have sort of public interest clause that opens up, proactively opens up information, vis-a-vis keeping that information to the point where it doesn't unnecessarily influence the markets. That was what was said in the standing committee, in any event, Chairperson, but the issue that is in the bill at this point in time is there's publication, annual publication of all investments made by the PIC, which I would agree with the submission from Kusato. Is an obvious issue in 2019, given our constitutional emphasis on openness, transparency, and accountability. I think there's no doubt about that. Chair, to Amo Bungane, I want to just deal with the issue of public participation. We have been shown a picture of the Grim Reaper on that matter, if I may use that metaphor. I don't think it's as bad as they pretend it to be, Chair, if I may say so, with respect. I think, firstly, the benchmark they're using for the Restitution of Land Rights Act is a 76 legislation, and there were issues in that 76 legislation that got stuck in the provincial processes. I think even in the National Assembly, and I'm reading from the case, it says, although the applicants aver that the National Assembly's public consultation process had certain shortcomings, they accept it was constitutionally compliant, and the judge then says, I agree. What am I trying to say with that? It is not an exact science, public participation. The test set by the Constitutional Court is that there must be a meaningful participation. Parliament must act reasonably to provide a meaningful participation, a meaningful opportunity for people to participate in the legislation. I think the crux of their emphasis, or the crux of their submission, was that we are rushing to prevent this bill from lapsing. And I'll deal with that question lastly after this point. I think there's a difference between what happened with let me just get the name of that bill. Otherwise, I'm going to go on. The restitution of land rights bill. And this bill is that it was a much more complex piece of legislation that compared to what we have before us here. And secondly, what we have before us is a Section 75 legislation, which does not need constitutionally to go for provincial mandates for provinces to agree or disagree or negotiate on the contents of that bill. So we have a Section 75 bill, and the powers there of the NCOP is to propose amendments. You can't make amendments. You can propose it. You know how it's done. It's put in the ATC, and then they look at those proposed amendments, and they simply decide whether they like it or not. So, Chair, I think that was some very high-level responses to what's coming out here. What I do want to just address, Chair, is the issue of the lapsing, as well as the COVID pressures that's been put on this bill, as Kosatu would indicate. I like that word, sorry. It's COVID, unless you're legal advisor and you get calls, it's 10 o'clock on a Sunday to deal with certain things. That's why I'm laughing. It wasn't so COVID for me. I mean, to advise, I don't get any pressure, Chair. But these things are there. But I want to say, Chair, to yourself and to the committee that you act as you know, and I'm saying it more to the benefit of other people that are here, that you are acting as a mechanism. The Constitution uses that name. You're a mechanism to maintain oversight. So you are a creature of the House, as well as the Constitution, because it says you must have committees. So you've been created, and you get a mandate from the House, in this instance, to consider and to report on the PIC Amendment Bill. So it is not for the committee, really, to stand up and say, well, we're not going to report. You have to report. You can report to say we haven't had enough time to consider it. And I'm not saying this to get into the hot water about it, but it has happened. I think with the Electronic Communications Amendment Bill that we've dealt with in the NA, they have reported to say it's too complex, it's not enough time for us to consider this bill, there's too many amendments, things have not been thought through, as well as there's not been proper engagement between the department in that, the Postal and Telecommunications Department, with stakeholders. So they've reported back to the House to say this is too much for us to deal with now. Okay, but nevertheless, you must report. So you can't not report. You can't, in other words, make the bill lapse in the committee. That cannot happen. That has to happen at the House, like you correctly said, Chair. So the committee needs to come up with a report about its opinion on the bill and its work on the bill, as you know. So Chair, in that regard, it would be for the committee to actually deal with this. And to report back, as said. And then if there are proposed amendments for the NA, to deal with those. Chair, just lastly, in respect of the Commission, and I just want to refer people who want to get into that area to look at the report from the Standing Committee on Finance. It is in the ATC. It's available on Parliament's website, or it should be, of 15 February, that deals with that. And I think Amo Bugane also raised the point. Well, remember that it's a structure of the executive, and the recommendations goes to the executive. Whether that executive releases that report speedily so that Parliament can then do a committee bill at that stage is a question that's open. It's not something we know now. If you look at the reports on the Zimbabwean elections way back under former President Thabo Mbeki, that report was not released, I think, after a court case. Force them to release it. So that is one point one must make. So Parliament has taken a decision to deal with certain things in the PAC, and we are at this process now in the NCOP. So maybe, Chair, just lastly about the proactive release of documents, what we said to that point in the Standing Committee on Finance was that, look, we have the Promotion of Access to Information Act that can be used. It's not to say that it's an idea that shouldn't be looked at, but at the moment there is legal backing for requesting information from an organ of state, including the PIC. And the PIC will have to comply with that act if it wants to refuse to give that information. So it is there. So it's not an alarmist issue. So, Chair, I think this is just bird's eye view on what was said, as well as the procedure which you'd like me to say something. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate Jenkins. In the referral, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, the referral of this bill, the last words is to consider and report. That means report to the NCOP plenary. That's what it means. I just want to clarify that. Coming out from the presentations this morning, since we started at 10 o'clock, it's very clear that Parliament have to improve on the oversight and committees. It's very clear to me. The PIC appears before the Standing Committee on Finance in the National Assembly. I would say they must appear at least twice a year. At least twice a year, because they're working with other people's money. I would like to see every quarter, but leave it there. Honourable members, the procedure will be that we will reconvene the SC Finance, the Committee for Finance, next Tuesday, the 19th of March, to deal with the draft report that the support staff will be starting to compile from tomorrow. Also on the 19th, later in the morning, before midday, public hearing on the financial, the Financial Matters Amendment Bill. I think, Roy, that's your terrain and Advocate van Schoor. Those hearings will be on the 26th of March, public hearings, and then it will go to plenary on the 28th. And then, honourable members, you must check your emails and messages from Estelle and Lubabalo regarding our meeting tomorrow of appropriations, the hearing on that public audit fees bill, amendment bill. I haven't checked it, so please check it, and I'll ask Estelle to just resend whatever message they want to send out for us. Honourable members, that brings us to the end of the business of this meeting of today. A long session in three parts. This meeting is closed and adjourned. And now you've got to endure the